afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio for another, episode. Oh.
Uh-oh. Am I on?
We're on, Roth.
Mic check.
We don't leave time for a mic check. That takes all the fun out of it.
I know it.
Oh, my gosh. So I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
There you go. And it's not material other than if you want to blame someone. We only gave you that information for possible blaming at a later date.
And there will be blaming.
Of course there will be.
Yes. but we only stop until somebody's crying.
Right.
That's right.
But we keep getting sick, so you can't tell which one of us is which because we all sound like men now.
Well, I think I'm still a man. I hope I'm still there.
Yeah, but sometimes I have to sound like a man.
Oh, I got you.
Like,
all right.
I called customer support, and the guy's like, yes, sir. Not only is he speaking to me in an accent, but he keeps calling me sir. It's like, I'm a man. Anyway, so thanks to our sponsor.
Powerhouse Solar.
There you go.
Yeah.
And get there.
You need solar assistance, get a hold of Bruce or Sue over there. They'll take good care of you.
Our local company. Been around for 12 years. They know stuff. They'll be here. So the fly-by-night guys that roll in with the, hey, you want to rent your roof to us or whatever, whatever they're up to.
Stay away from that.
Yeah, don't do that.
Call local.
Call Bruce and Sue. we have a really interesting continuation. We have not talked to William Kay since it was a year ago. It was February 2015.
Yeah.
I keep forgetting we're in 2017. We haven't talked to him in 2 years, but he sent me this great video where he was kind of just shredding the whole Paris climate talks and what they're all up to. And I thought, oh, we must have him on again. It just so in keeping with our theme of late. So you can find all of his information. You can find all of his information at ecofascism.com. We've got all his stuff linked and videos and things like that because we haven't had video in previous interviews. We have not had video from him. We've only had audio things. So his videos are linked at wethepeopleradio.us.
There you have it.
Okay, that's all the homework. William, are you hiding in there in the phone?
I am. I'm in the phone.
As our hostage?
Yeah.
How's it going, William?
Very well. It's warm now in Edmonton, Alberta.
Oh, wow.
We just went through a terrible cold snap. It was below 20 below Celsius, which is below 5 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that's too
below
cold
zero,
for me.
Like for a good solid week and a half.
Yeah, we actually got some of that down here as well. I mean, we actually got snow in Redding, which is a little bit unusual, but
Well, that's good news for you guys
because
you were short of water. So
yep.
No, we're still going to be short of water. Are you kidding me? They've decided that they need to run it all out through the Delta. They're busy blowing it to the ocean.
We're in permadrought. Yeah, they don't want to let that go.
We don't want to have any water by the time all this extra water gets done coming down. So,
well, if you need water, you talk to us up in Canada. We have 10% of the world's supply of fresh water.
Wow.
And we've got more water pouring into the Arctic Ocean than California could consume in a millennia.
Oh, we need to build a pipeline. Oh, no, that doesn't go over very well either,
actually,
does it?
If you go on my website, there's a lengthy collection of articles called The Great Wahapa Project, because in the 1960s there was a lot of talk about using river diversions, et cetera, to get some of these northern rivers diverted down into the U.S. Southwest. You know, there was engineering firms that had complete blueprints of that. It was doable and economically doable in the 1960s. With today's technology, be a lead pipe cinch. But always been kicked around. You know, major water diversion projects like Canada, particularly northern Canada, has got enormous water resources that are not being used at all. Just north of here, there's a river that's actually larger than the Rhine River in Europe, and 4 villages live along it, 10,000 people. Whereas the Rhine River has got 50 cities living along it.
Wow.
And that river flows into the Arctic Ocean. Mm. Nobody's using that water at all.
Well, I've always wondered why, you know, every year you have all these major floods and everything going on in the east, and then we have a drought out here. Got a big, great big pipe would just really solve a lot of that. And it can't be that expensive.
That's been kicked around for a long time. The environmentalists have blocked all of that talk.
Well, they put
If you're east of the Mississippi, there's too much water. West of the Mississippi, not so much.
Right, Right. And you know, they put these big fiber optic lines all over the place, and there's always somebody digging a big trench and filling it back in. That's really not that technical to dig a trench, put a pipe in it, and cover it up.
And you don't have to worry about the pipe breaking. I mean, it isn't like it's poisoning some field. It's like water on the ground, right? So there's no great environmental catastrophe.
Oh, come on.
You haven't
been to California lately.
Yeah, you put water on the ground where it doesn't belong, and you are in big trouble.
We can turn any substance into an environmental catastrophe.
That's right, because once you put the water on the ground, now you got fairy shrimp. Now you can't get rid of the water.
Yeah,
now
but my favorite was when they dug out the Shasta Lake. They were digging new footings for a different bridge. They were changing the bridge over. They dug out the footings. Well, so instead of taking the lake bottom, the dirt and whatever, I don't know, it's probably just mud. Instead of taking that and just putting it in a different place in the lake, they had to haul it away as toxic waste.
Yeah, because it was in the water to start with.
It was in the lake. You couldn't just move it over.
Yeah. Well, they obviously know much more about that.
And you know, when the tsunami came, I got another one. When the tsunami came over in Crescent City, in order to recover their harbor, obviously the harbor got,
filled back in with sand.
Right. So instead of taking that and putting it back out toward the ocean or somewhere like that, no, they had to haul that away as toxic waste too.
Yeah.
Put it in a landfill.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's too toxic. You got to spend extra.
Because, if California, continues to do this, the entire planet's going to benefit. You know, we're going to change the ecosystem of the whole planet. So you got to do your homework, William. You got to figure out what we're doing
here. Landscaping,
Yeah. So,
so you've been hammering the Paris Accord and the I forget what you called it, the climate industrial complex, which I thought was it was a fun new term. I liked it a lot. Where would you like to begin?
Well, if you want to bring this right up to speed, there's a real Russian angle to this. You've noticed that Russia is in the news a lot lately.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well. Back in 2012, President-elect Donald Trump, as he then was, made a tweet where he's sometimes backtracking this, but he more or less said that he thought that global warming was a Chinese hoax. On several occasions, he's called it a hoax. He's right. I wouldn't use the word hoax. I would use the word economic warfare. And I don't really blame the Chinese. They certainly slithered their way into this in a way that would cause them no harm. But the people who are really responsible for the global warming economic warfare campaign are the Europeans. It is the EU. These are the countries that were on the ground floor of this project. They are the ones who have devoted far more resources to renewable energies and the like. Than any other country in the world. This is really a campaign unquestionably driven by our allies in Berlin. With Donald Trump being elected, in all likelihood, America's climate policies are going to shift dramatically. He's got four or five people in the cabinet, and I can name them, who've already gone on record, being climate contrarians or what I like to call climate realists. The bottom line is this. If America drops cooperation with climate change, climate activism, their relationship with Europe will deteriorate very rapidly. And it ties into Russian relations because Putin has also made a number of remarks indicating that he doesn't believe in climate change. Russia, like the United States, is a natural energy superpower. They have tremendous coal, oil, and gas reserves, like Russia, like Canada. You cannot say that of the European Union.
That's true.
The reason why climate makes sense to the Europeans is because they are trying to achieve European energy independence. This is the EU imports, by last count, almost $600 billion a year of fossil fuels into the EU. They are hemorrhaging enormous amounts of money, and most of that money is going to their longtime rivals and adversaries, the Russians, the Arabs, what have you.
Because they don't have the fossil fuels, is that correct?
They simply do not have any oil in the ground.
Right.
They've got a little bit of coal here and there, no natural gas. Most of the countries in Europe are importing 100% of their fossil fuels. That is not our problem in North America.
Amen.
This is their problem. And what I tried to point out in that paper on the climate, on the Paris climate change, if you look at the history of global warming, you go back to the OPEC crisis of the 70s. At that time, the leading governments of Europe were issuing public statements and, you know, they formed the IEA and a bunch of other organizations where they very explicitly said, we have to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. We have to start transitioning towards renewable energies. Those statements were coming out in the mid-1970s. The climate change campaign starts several years later. It's obvious the motivation behind the climate change campaign. It's this transition to renewable energies. That makes sense if you're in Europe, but so the historical point is, they were several years, almost a decade into their own campaign for European energy security before they refurbished their campaign and started calling it climate change, started calling it global warming. They recruited a chunk of the scientific community to act as propagandists for them. But what is driving this is the quest for European energy independence. Europe is a very powerful player on the world scene. They have their rivalries for sure. But you can bet that as Donald Trump starts to implement his climate change agenda, relations with Europe are going to go right down the toilet bowl.
God, that is something I hadn't really thought about. When I listened to your video, I thought, oh, yeah, we don't look at that very often. Let's come back and talk about that. We've got to take a really quick break here. We're here with William Kay. He is the purveyor of the website ecofascism.com. He's got tons of information on there, too, by the way. Thank our sponsors.
Powerhouse Solar.
Trying to get Bill to talk. It's really hard.
I'm mesmerized. I got a million questions. I'm just...
We busted Bill into multitasking overload. We'll be right back. I believe they wrote a song all those years ago about exactly what happens today. That's so weird.
They were time travelers.
Exactly. Another plug for time travel. All right, William.
William, I got a question. I got to ask. You know, we're talking about it, when Trump takes office, his policies are going to raise havoc with Europe. Why couldn't why doesn't the U.S. put themselves in a position where we supply resources, oil, coal, whatever, to Europe? I mean, we've got vast quantities that we aren't even tapping. And, I mean, just the threat of that, I would think, would drop oil prices from OPEC dramatically, and everybody would be happy. I mean, doesn't make sense about that?
Well, you're not proposing that we give them fuel as some sort of charity.
But we could sell it. I mean,
a lot of people in Europe have a very low opinion of America as well. As far as they were concerned, as far as they are concerned, you know, the United States is their number one rival. It wouldn't solve their problem. Their problem is they are hemorrhaging $500 billion a year. That money is going to the Russians and to the Arabs. To simply say, now you get to give hundreds of billions of dollars a year to the American economy. That's still an economic rival. their goal is a Europe that has nothing but electric vehicles, where those electric vehicles are powered by wind and solar, where all the wind and solar facilities are constructed on European soil. That's their goal. Their goal is true independence. Their goal is by 2040, not a single internal combustion engine on the road. Every vehicle in Europe is going to be electric, and they're going to be powered by renewable energies and by methane from garbage and what have you. They are devoted to that, simply shifting up the country upon whom they are dependent would not be deemed a solution to them. And never lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of people in the European Union, our allies in Berlin, who have a very low opinion of America.
Oh, yeah, and that's, you know, there's a whole host of reasons for that. But I've read recently that some of these European nations are kind of backing away from, you know, especially wind power and that. It's just not penciling out. I mean, they're spending billions of dollars on it.
Yeah, where's their electricity going to come from?
Well, I mean, that's what I'm saying. Why can't we give them another option?
Well, there's nothing at present preventing Americans from selling petroleum to the Europeans or selling coal to them. What you're recommending is the solution. What they should be doing, what I think, is that, you know, these wealthy German businesses and governments should be investing heavily into coal production in the United States and Canada, digging up the coal, working with joint ventures with American firms, and shipping the coal back. If they would do that, they would not be hemorrhaging as much money. Mm-hmm. But and you're right. Europe is very divided. I mean, there are some people who see this as a doomed scenario. But I'm looking at the Wind Europe website, and they are boasting that they want to have Europe 40% powered by wind in the next 20 years. Like, all electricity in Europe is going to come from wind. They're currently investing over $100 billion a year in wind construction. Over 250,000 Europeans are working just in sort of wind installment, wind construction. As far as they're concerned, this is an energy war, and they're striving for independence and energy security. And if you don't have the fossil fuels in the ground, then this is what you're going to have to do. You're making a legitimate offer, but I think in the minds of the sort of the European class, they would be just trading,
dependence.
Maybe giving money to the Americans as opposed to the Russians, and in their mind, that's not such a wonderful deal.
Hmm. Yeah, I can kind of understand that, but their options are fairly limited. I mean, when you don't have the resources, you've got to make a deal with somebody.
As the French say, we don't have oil, we have ideas.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And their big idea. Yeah. Well, it's a lot of the climate skeptics in America keep talking about how crazy this thing is. This whole global warming thing is just crazy. It's not crazy if you're in Europe, because they were in on the ground floor of this. They were developing, wind farms and solar power in the late 1970s in response to the OPEC crisis.
But is it penciling out for them? I mean, is their energy cost? It's got to be way higher than what...
Six times. Electricity is six times more expensive in Germany than America.
Why aren't the people over there recognizing that and going with a cheaper alternative?
That means, they can forget about energy independence. That means they would have to be importing gas and oil and coal from the rest of the world. It's kind of like Denmark import like 100% of their coal. They import all of their gas and all of their oil. Germany imports all of its oil. It would still be more market. In the long run, what they really fear is that if they let market trends play out as they are, Europe ultimately becomes a second tier part of the world. Mm-hmm. Not only are they going to be handing out hundreds of billions of dollars a year to their rivals, the United States, the Russians, are going to have much lower energy costs. Already, a lot of European firms are leaving Europe because electricity costs, energy costs are such an important part of doing business. It just doesn't make sense to be there anymore. And if they're relying on intermittent and highly expensive forms of electricity, it's very difficult for a lot of these big, sophisticated plants to operate. So the fear that the Europeans have is that if we simply allowed the market to do its thing, they are doomed. They are doomed to becoming sort of a second world country, whereas other parts of the world are going to race ahead. Their strategy was to transition their own economies to the non-fossil fuel sector and get in on the ground floor of those technologies. Three of the world's largest wind turbine manufacturers are in Europe. They supply about almost half of the world's turbines are being manufactured in Europe. 99% of the turbines being deployed in Europe are manufactured locally. They're having a more difficult time with solar panels because the Asians have so cut into the market. But the plan was, you know, we transition to the clean economy, the green economy. Then we try to impose this on the entire world. And then the entire world comes and buys our panels, our turbines, our biofuel digesters and what have you. This was going to be a win-win situation for them.
For them.
As opposed to hemorrhaging money buying fossil fuels, they're going to make money selling fossil fuel replacing technology.
Right. Which is great. I mean, that's a great plan if it worked, but it didn't work. And I don't think it ever will.
It's their plan.
Right.
It's a plan you would come up with if you didn't have any fossil fuels. Like, America doesn't have a shortage of coal.
No.
Europe has a shortage of coal.
Well, we certainly don't have a shortage of oil either.
Oil or natural gas or uranium.
Right.
America is a natural energy superpower.
Mm-hmm.
The whole climate change campaign was tailored to countries that don't have these things.
Right.
It also plays well in places like New York City or Los Angeles because they fear if you allow the markets to go forward, there would be a lot of migration into the heartland of America.
Mm-hmm.
Places like Wyoming and Oklahoma and Dakotas and Texas, there would be a shift in population away from the coastal areas. Once again, congregating around where the fossil fuels and energy would be the cheapest. So it kind of works. You'll see the Europeans have got allies amongst the coastal elites of America. And if you saw the last election, that was pretty obvious. But in the main sort of heartlands of America, no. This whole climate change campaign is an economic disaster.
Well,
I have a National Football League analogy.
Okay.
Do you want to hear it?
Absolutely.
Now, full disclosure, I'm not a football fan.
Hey, neither are we.
I'm a martial arts fan. But here's the analogy. The New Orleans Saints, they lead the National Football League in passing. They have the best passing team. The San Francisco 49ers are the worst. Now, if you could imagine, what if the San Francisco 49ers started to lobbying the NFL commission, say, let's phase out passing. We'll say it's destroying football. It's destroying attendance. Attendance is going down because the fans don't want to see any more forward passing. And, of course, you know, the New Orleans Saints would say, well, you guys are just saying that because your passing game sucks. And they'd say, well, are you in denial that the attendance is declining? It'd be that sort of an argument.
Right.
Like the European Union would be like the San Francisco 49ers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we can phase out fossil fuels, then we're a competitive part of the world again. If we allow the fossil fuel economy, I don't even like using the word fossil fuel, like the hydrocarbon economy, oil, coal, and natural gas. If we allow that to flourish, Europe is doomed. Europe is not going to be winning any championships. So what they are trying to do is fundamentally change the rules of the game to make themselves more competitive. And that's the small gear that turns this other gear when you realize this whole global warming thing is an absolute hoax.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's all these, you know, theories as to how, you know, of course, there's a lot of people who are aware that climate change, you know, the catastrophic, anthropogenic, global warming hypothesis is rather untenable. But where the climate skeptical community falls apart, then they try to explain, well, how does this happen? Like, how does something that's clearly scientifically dubious, and that's an understatement, how does that become the consensus? How does that become something that you have to hear about every day on the national news.
Mm-hmm.
And then they come up with all kinds of screwball conspiracy theories and mass psychology theories as to what's driving this. What it really is a form of neocolonialism. The European Union is having an effect on American culture, Canadian culture. They are, you know, there's over 500 million people living in the European Union. These are sophisticated, advanced societies, and they have a deep amount of control over the American mainstream media. And it is through that they're able to perpetrate this.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you one example of that. There's a German multinational called Bertelsmann, and it is a mass media company in Europe. It's one of Europe's biggest television networks, radio networks, puts out over 500 magazines and online offerings, what have you. But it is also the world's largest publisher of books, 15,000 new titles each year. Bertelsmann owns 250 smaller publishing companies that it makes no effort to inform the public are all centralized in Bertelsmann. About 50% of all the books, the new books being purchased in America, are coming from that company. And the family that owns that company have been involved in the Club of Rome, which is this ultra-green, ultra-environmentalist, neo-fascist group in Europe. The Mon family own 100% of the voting shares of Bertelsmann. And they are, like, you know, by quite a margin, the largest book publisher in the world, the largest publisher of English language books in the world. There's another family called the Holzbrinks from Germany. Once again, major mass media company. They put out Scientific American, Nature magazine. A lot of the pop science magazines out there are all coming from the Holzbrinks family. And once again, as with the Mullins, you know, in impeccable Nazi pedigree. These were families that were very involved in the Third Reich, in promoting propaganda in the Third and for the Third Reich, and now they are absolutely dominating book and magazine media in the United States.
Wow.
I could list several companies like that.
Let's do that.
That are European-based.
Do that in just a second. We've got to take another really quick break.
Sounds good. Do it.
And you have a really good video about that, too, by the way. So people should go to the website, wethepeopleradio.us, and it's all listed on there for you. We'll be back with William Kay in just a couple of seconds. Continue on.
We're back.
See, it was just seconds.
Okay.
I never say 2 minutes anymore. I'm just going to say seconds because it seems shorter. All right. So, the Nazis never go away, do they? Kind of funny. Everybody always likes to bring it up, and then we all tell them to, you know, don't be silly, but I guess maybe we're just not paying attention.
Fascism is sort of a shape-shifting phenomenon. It doesn't always use the same rhetoric. There are certain basic interests that keep coming out, but they're very skilled at sort of, you know, morphing and rebranding themselves and coming out a slightly different. And of course, history does not really repeat itself. It's always something new. History is very linear. What you're really seeing is sort of the European old money, the European aristocracy. They were always opposed to democracy. They were always opposed to capitalism. And they were never, driven from power. They know how to lie low periodically, and they know how to sort of resurface themselves. I'm noticing with a lot of this anti-Trump stuff, they're sure throwing the word fascism around a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And these are people who really do not know what they're talking about. If I had to pick which of those two main parties in the United States has the greatest similarities to fascism, it's undoubtedly the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of stuff on my website, because it's called Environmentalism is Fascism. Half that equation is fascism. So I have put a lot of energy over the years in reading about fascism. There's a book put out by Oxford called The Oxford Handbook on Fascism. It's about a, you know, 800-page brick. And it's sort of, this is Oxford's effort to sort of explain what fascism is. And I condensed that down with, you know, supplementation from a bunch of other encyclopedias and what have you, down to about, you know, my definition of fascism, which runs about 70, 80 pages. But, you know, what fascism was, just to go off on a tangent here, it's really the sort of political regimes you saw in Europe from the end of World War One to 1945. Of course, some of them in France and, I mean, in Spain and Portugal lasted much longer. But those regimes are not at all like Donald Trump. The old school fascists were really opposed to capitalism. They certainly weren't, you know, leftists. They didn't want to sort of expropriate the property of the rich, certainly not the landlords. But they had a vision of what they called the corporatist ethic, where it was a super regulated form of economy. They were quite opposed to democracy. I mean, you got all these people in the United States who are, you know, it sounds like they really want to overturn the results of the last election.
They keep trying.
Like, you know, they're willing to use violence to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's almost a textbook definition of fascism. I mean, time and again, what you saw in Europe is after World War One, a lot of the monarchies fell. You had this sort of democratic revolutions that had happened in Germany and Austria, and then there was this reaction where the old guard tried to reimpose themselves upon, you know, the system, and to retake the state away from the democratically elected government. That is what you've seen, you know, and then there are several countries around the world since then. But that's classic fascism. You know, it really comes from the oligarchy, the old money, the wealthiest sort of landlords from the aristocracy. They despise the lower classes. They don't think that, you know, there's at least, you know, fascists will say things like, you know, the common people are just too ignorant and too stupid to understand financial policy or foreign policy. So why are we even asking their opinion?
Boy, who's that
sound really,
like?
They really, at a fundamental level, don't believe in democracy. They believe in sort of having the sort of old clique of the first families running the whole show. And that's what you saw in Europe, and in country after country. There was an opening to democracy, and then the door just got slammed shut, and you had, you know, Mussolini in Italy and Hitler in Germany. And there were 24 different fascist dictatorships across Europe, you know, from the gates of Moscow to the White Cliffs of Dover. You know, by 1941, every country in Europe had a fascist dictator.
Well,
and
see,
there were several million people who were members of fascist political parties, and maybe 200 of them got hung in Nuremberg.
Yeah.
Well, these guys here talk about fascism. You know, they call somebody a fascist because they don't like them. They really don't. They're not matching any kind of ideology. It's just, if you're a bad person, you're Hitler.
It's got nothing to do with.
Oh, I don't know where their brains are really at. There's a lot of people who have, you know, basically been brainwashed or, I don't know, seriously indoctrinated. The universities are in many ways the main culprits of this. But what you see every time there is a fascist movement, there's sort of this mass goon squad of people who all they got is the talking points, and that's about it. But they can be quite dangerous and violent. So I'm definitely going to be tuned in on the inauguration day. I had the sort of timeline. It's only like 4 days, and, you know, here we are. I've got it. 4 days, 20 hours, 14 minutes, and 8 seconds until the inauguration. But it would not surprise me at all to see, you know, blood in the streets.
Oh, no. I think this is going to be a real huge wake-up call for a lot of people. But, you know, William, I want to get back to one thing. We kind of left it for a minute there. As far as the EU is concerned and fossil fuels versus renewable energy, what would be the ramifications if, if the United States said, hey, you know what, we're going to become self-reliant on fossil fuels. We've got all we need. We can sustain ourselves for hundreds of years. We really don't need any more of this BS coming out of Europe. If you guys want to get on board, and I think maybe not just the United States, but North America, include Canada. Canada's in the same position. I mean, they've got huge natural resources. If North America, you know, just got together and said, hey, we're gonna play our own energy game, and if you guys want to be included, great. If not, you know, you do your thing, we'll do ours. What would happen? I mean, we're looking at World War III if something like that really came to pass.
Nicolas Sarkozy, who was the former president of France, who is running again for the presidency of France, has already said, as soon as Trump got elected, he's said that Europe must impose carbon tariffs on all goods imported from the United States. Like, we're going to impose climate tariffs on all of your goods. And he's not some fringe guy. He is one of the most influential figures in France right now. And there's a lot of other European leaders who are of the same sort of view, that they are going to penalize and punish America if America does not play ball on the climate front.
But that's really kind of a hollow – isn't that kind of a hollow threat, really? I mean, yeah, we're in a position right now where we're importing probably more than we ever have. We don't really manufacture that much here. I mean, I know we have, you know – businesses here that make cars overseas and so forth. But, I mean, most of our goods, let's face it, come from China, Japan. The EU isn't really that – we aren't going to get hurt that much market-wise if they – I mean, they would get hurt more than we would, wouldn't they?
Well, they're the ones who are the targets. I'm looking at it right now. American exports to the EU, $495 billion. So it's fairly substantial still. It would hurt. We could sort of live without them, but it's sort of that deteriorating relationship. I mean, even in the United States, if the Trump administration, and if you look at his cabinet, there are four people there who are pretty obviously climate skeptics. Add Trump, he got five, mm-hmm. You know, and the guys he has in charge of the EPA, the interior, energy, these guys are all climate skeptics.
Right.
So if they do the right thing and just drop a lot of these regulations, there is going to be turmoil in America. You know, you in America, there are tens of thousands of people working in the wind industry, et cetera. Biofuels, there's a lot of farmers who are growing corn to turn into ethanol. If not for the regulations that the government is imposing on that, they'll have to go back to growing food again. I'm saying there's going to be some adjustment here.
Okay, yeah, but I think a lot of that could be offset. Can't a lot of that be offset by just easing the regulations and let them grow food and export it? I mean, there's a lot of countries out there that would love to, you know, import our groceries.
But it's not win-win. I mean, if they said, okay, we're going to drop any of this requirement that you add ethanol to your fuel, it's a big chunk. It's about half of the corn market right now is going into ethanol. Those farmers would be upset. They're not going to starve to death, but they're going to take a hit. The consumers would benefit because food prices would fall. I'm all for that. Like, you know, I think it's one of the worst things that climate change has done is to support this whole biofuels industry, because we're basically telling farmers to grow a harvest. We're paying them more than the market would pay, and we're burning it.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
That's just an outrage.
It is.
I'm all for eliminating any sort of subsidies to biofuels, but let's not pretend that that's going to be popular in certain states.
Right. No, that'll be a big fight.
That's going to be a financial hit. Yep. Okay, so apply that to Europe. I mean, the climate industries, the climate industrial complexes, biofuels, wind power, you know, all the smart meters and the fast chargers for the electric cars and that, this is a huge industrial complex. Any politician in Europe says, okay, forget it. You know, let's just drop all this crap and move on to something else. It would be, you know, 10 times worse than trying to pitch, you know, the end of ethanol in Iowa. I don't think this is something that Europe can, it's too big to fail, right? It's something that they can really stop and do something else. You and I can come up with better ideas for Europe as to how they might meet their energy needs in the future. But this is something that's so deeply entrenched and so big in Europe, I don't think they can turn it around. And I think they're going to develop a very hostile attitude towards the United States if the United States does the right thing and walks away from this whole malarkey.
Right. But, you know, also I think we have to consider that the EU is in trouble. I mean, there's a lot of countries over there now thinking, you know what, this isn't working for us. And, you know, Britain's out. There was somebody else talking about bailing,
France
too.
France are talking about
yeah,
it.
France, yeah. If the EU does fall apart, these countries are going to be back on an even footing where they can make their own deals with foreign governments on their energy. They're not going to be hamstrung by all these regulations and power brokers in the EU. So, I mean, that's a big factor as well.
It is. This could end up breaking the EU.
Which I don't think would be a bad thing.
More. Oh, I would support it completely.
Mm-hmm.
In Europe right now, there are 97 million people who speak German, first language. Of course, it's the Federal Republic of Germany. It's Austria. It's most of Switzerland. Basically, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg. Around them, there's a cluster of states, most notably Denmark and Sweden, Slovenia and Croatia, that are completely integrated into the German-speaking world. And their collective numbers are probably about 120 million. That is the Fourth Reich. And what we saw with Brexit, that was the Second Battle of Britain. That was Britain breaking away from a very much German-dominated EU. France is seriously talking about breaking away from a very German-dominated EU. But what you're left with then is, you know, this basically Fourth Reich. Well, what it ends up looking like are the battle lines of World War One, the
yes.
battle lines
yes.
of World War Two.
Yes.
And to the east, there is this centuries-old competition between the German-speaking realm and the Russian-speaking realm, and the poor bastards who were stuck in between them.
Yep. It always comes back to Germany.
And the crushing will begin. One more quick break before the top of the hour. We're going to come back with our guest, William Kay. We've got a whole nother hour with him. We roped him into two. Thanks, William. You're
no
listening
problem.
To We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Every time we stop, hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
William, we have like
yeah,
2 minutes till the top of the hour. Are you just, like, enjoying the music today? Because I'm sorry, but Bob's killing it.
He's always good. He's always on the ball, that guy. It's rare to have a...
Allentown was awesome.
...studio guy that actually listens to the show.
Yeah, listens to the show, pays attention, and knows music that was written before 2014. We had a guy once. We had a substitute guy who was an engineer, and we asked him to play a song, and he looked at us like we were...
Yeah.
You know, and it was like Steely Dan.
What movie was that from?
It was like Steely Dan or something. We're like, what? You don't even know that? I guess all we really have time for is to give people a little sneak preview on what are we going to talk about next hour?
I'd like to go back
so they don't get bored.
Back to the beginning.
Well, you're William, but we call
no
you
worries,
Bill.
Man.
Oh,
no
sorry.
Worries. I can.
Oh, I know in one of your videos
I've got a few topics I can kick up here.
Well, in one of your videos I was listening to you talk about the Earth's climate has been changing since the beginning. So we can't argue
well, if
that
you
there...
want to get into the science, yeah, I could talk about that for another 2 hours.
Oh, yeah.
I do like the EU thing, though.
Oh, God,
can we do more on that?
I want to make a few few more points. I haven't really brought in the whole Russian thing yet, which is what I was trying to do.
Sorry.
when we started. But any sort of science question on climate, yeah, like I've been reading about this topic now for over 20 years.
I was hoping never to have to read about it, but now we all have to get smart about it.
We all have to be experts.
Well, now it's going to get really, really interesting. Now there's actually going to be a debate in American society.
Oh.
We've never had that before.
That's true. That's true, because we've all been just labeled as haters.
Yeah, so you know, there's this intercom in the corner that's just, you know, that's half the debate, and we don't get to respond to it.
Right, right. The science is settled. I love those people. They come into my office periodically. The science is settled. I'm like, you know, just by virtue of the fact that it's science, it can't be settled.
Mm-hmm.
Or it shouldn't be settled.
Oh, it's pretty much settled now that people understand that global warming is an absolute hoax. Yeah, that's the emerging consensus.
See,
certainly in the Republican Party.
I should have you hang out at work with me one day.
Answer the phones.
We would have so much fun. All right, we're going to be back for the next hour with William Kay. We'll try to get our breaks on time so we don't have them all crammed at the end. Sorry about that. Thanks to our sponsor, Powerhouse Solar. And you're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. Welcome back to the second hour of We the People Radio. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. Pretty simple.
Yep, pretty simple.
The .com owner still has not let go of his domain. He's ruining my world. So that bitterness is connected to only me, Aaron Ryan. It's just my opinion. It's the only one I get.
That's right. I don't share that view.
Yeah, exactly. And who are you?
Yeah, I'm Bill Cunningham. And I want to take a second
He's Bill. Don't call him William.
Our sponsor,
we have William. Don't call him Bill.
Don't make it technical.
Yeah, yeah.
Our sponsor this hour is Powerhouse Solar. Bruce and Sue over there can do you a great job on any of your solar power needs.
And they live here, and they're not going door to door and moving to some other place.
And you can call them at 275-5600 or catch them online at powerhousesolar.com.
Check. And they're right on the front page of our site in case you are not driving with a pen and you're not driving with a phone and – but you are probably driving with a hamburger and a little dog. You can still do that.
That's still legal. I saw a lady the other day throw a chicken bone out the window. You can eat fried chicken, too.
Yeah, you can do whatever you want. Yeah. Just don't talk on the phone. Don't touch it. You're not allowed to touch the phone.
That's right.
Because we're in California.
You can't have it in your hand now.
That's right. You can't have it in your hand. So I guess
you're lucky you can still listen to the radio and drive.
Exactly. Don't touch the knob, though. You probably can't touch the knob. We're going to need cars with telepathic ability so that we can think our stuff going on. And all of our music comes from the Indomitable.
Oh, Bob Martin.
You're still Bob?
I was sending you a telepathic message. I was trying it out, see if I could get it to work here. Because if I can, then maybe it'll work in the truck.
Yay.
Yeah. All right. William Kay?
Yes.
You just start out wherever you want because we keep skipping this Russian thing. We keep getting derailed.
I have no problem with getting into the science. We can do that in a moment. I just wanted to sort of round out something that I had started talking about earlier. But this requires a mentioning of one specific historical fact and then a general historical trend.
Will it make all the snowflakes melt?
Historical fact. Go ahead.
Is it going to make all the snowflakes melt? Are they going to freak out when you say it?
They will be stunned.
Nice.
Okay, the shock might even cure them of their depression. Who knows?
Oh.
I hope not.
Do say.
These are the people who are in need of a wake-up call.
Yes.
The diplomatic revolution of 1756. Now, most people are not aware of that. It's sort of pre the American War of Independence, although it's one of the things that caused it. But what happened in Europe, the four main powers at the time, Austria, France, Prussia, and Britain, suddenly changed partners, like in a very quick period. The ones that had been bitter enemies for long periods of time suddenly switched partners and became allies. That was known as the capital D, capital R, diplomatic revolution. It has happened in the past that countries that have had long periods of animosity suddenly overnight become allies. Okay, the second point is that over the last hundreds of years in Europe, in Central and Eastern Europe, there's been this very deeply entrenched divide between the sort of the Russian Slavic world and the Germanic Central European world. The Kingdom of Sweden fought 15 wars against the Tsar. The Austrians had repeated wars against the Tsars. The Prussians did as well. It wasn't as though they were always at war with one another. And they were, I mean, the Germanic countries and the Russian countries. But it was definitely the long-term trend. And this is something that isn't going to get washed away by any sort of change anytime soon. There's still this entrenched animosity between those two blocks. And during World War I and World War II, of course, America was allied with Russia against the Central European powers. Once the Cold War started, the Americans and the Soviet Union became bitter enemies for over 40 years. Right now, there is this tension between the Eastern Europe, the sort of Central European powers and Russia, and their great fear, the mortifying fear of the Europeans, is that the Americans are going to switch sides. And what's going to happen in America over the next year is a lot of people are really going to sit down and say, remind me, why is it that the Russians are the enemies and that the EU are the allies? Like, what is going on? Why is that the case? Why are we not, why are we involved in this at all? Why is America sending hundreds of tanks, through Poland to the Russian border? Trump is leading this. And I very much support Donald Trump, and I think he's doing exactly the right thing. He's really questioning, why is it that we're having such, animosity with Russia? Why can't we get along with Russia? But it's closely tied to the climate thing. If America's going to walk away from the climate campaign, because it doesn't make any economic sense for America, Russia was bribed into the climate thing. They got the same deal as China and India. You don't have to do anything. If you look at the countries with the least amount of solar power and wind power and biofuels, there's Russia. They have done absolutely nothing to cooperate with this. On several occasions, Putin has made the same sort of remarks that you get from Trump. Like, Putin has repeatedly said, hey, this is Russia. It's too cold here. Like, we don't care if the planet's going to increase a degree or two. But they bribed him with saying you can get membership in the World Trade Organization. What the Russians really want more than anything is acceptance into the mainstream world community. That's something that Trump can really offer them. So while Trump's position on climate is going to cause him make a lot of enemies in the EU, if he warms up to Putin at the same time, that's going to make even a lot more enemies. But Russia and the U.S. are both these natural energy superpowers to whom this whole climate thing is just a nuisance. So those are the grander sort of geopolitical trends. And that's why you've got all this Russian stuff going on in the mass media. It's not just driven by the Europeans, but they are mortified of the possibility that the Americans and the Russians might really start getting along, that they might really start talking about what are the best energy policies for their countries. That's very bad news for the Europeans.
We might take our toys and go home from the climate folderol.
Then they're stuck. If neither Russia nor America is going to cooperate with the climate thing, like the whole project is pointless, even from the Europeans' perspective.
Well, they're counting on us to fund it. I mean, bottom line is they just want to strip us down so that they can redistribute our money.
Don't forget China's a major player in this, too. But it seems like everything I hear about China is they're, like, exempt until, 2030
China
or something.
And they don't have to do anything. Yeah. They would never have signed on to this.
No. Well, if they did, they wouldn't have done it anyway.
that's probably true. So where are the Canadians in this whole thing? I know it's a big place and you have a lot of variety, but your leadership's kind of down.
The government we have now of Justin Trudeau, who is the son of a previous prime minister, who I have profiled on my website, He is very much a tool and instrument of the Europeans. Canada is very divided east to west. You're talking to someone from Western Canada, where we do have a lot of oil, coal, natural gas, what have you, as opposed to sort of the Toronto-Montreal corridor, mm-hmm. which dominates Canadian politics. But we've got a prime minister and a party in power in Ottawa that his, they are as committed to the whole climate agenda as was Obama. And they are now in a quandary as to what to do now that Trump has been elected. They haven't changed their tune yet, but they're it's a big difficulty because America is beyond just being our major trading partner. They're the source of almost 90% of our exports and imports. We are completely integrated into the American economy and to the American culture. But yet we've got a political party in power now that is a neo-colonial governor appointed by the Europeans, basically. And even in the there was this freak election that we had in Alberta, the province I'm in Canada, and they had the political party that won are also these hardcore environmentalists, and it was only because the mainstream parties had sort of split and sort of fighting amongst themselves, and these guys came up the middle and won, and you really get the sense of, before the American Revolution, you had governors. England would send a governor. You would, send a president to America, and he would tell you what the policies were going to be, and he was doing this on behalf of Britain. He wasn't doing it for you. It wasn't your interest he was trying to implement. That's the kind of premier we have in this province right now. This is someone who is imposing climate policies. They're implementing a carbon tax. This is like one of the biggest oil-producing provinces in the world, jurisdictions in the world, and implementing this multi-billion-dollar carbon tax, gasoline fuel tax, and they're going to give all of the revenues from that to the wind power industry. And this is extremely unpopular here. And if you want to talk about a place in the world where this makes absolutely no sense, I mean, Alberta, if you include the oil sands, it's got more oil than Iraq. This is one of the ultimate natural energy superpowers of the world. Tremendous amount of oil, coal, natural gas. These are the industries we should be promoting. We're having a very hard time getting pipelines built. The Keystone XL was supposed to come to Alberta. It was supposed to go right through Edmonton, where I'm currently sitting. And that was, of course, blocked by the Obama administration. Trump is going to okay that. But we've got a premier in this province right now who pays lip service to fighting for pipelines, but really isn't doing anything about it. It probably is not a sustainable situation politically, and ultimately, hopefully, they will be removed. But they've brought in hundreds of environmental activists and given them these rather plum positions all over the government.
Sure.
These are people who are on record as being militantly opposed to the petroleum industry.
We see that. We see that here. We see these guys getting paid to go protest. And hey, and California just gave Eric Holder a job. So yet again are leading the way.
Good news though, because he is such a legal moron.
I know.
He's only going to undermine efforts they are trying to come up with to thwart Trump.
Exactly.
Well, he'll just say whatever they pay.
He'll just make it look all the more sensible for the northern part of the state to be split away so we can be free. What's that?
California independence movement.
I know. I hope they go. Weird. No, we're going to stay. See, then we don't have to split away from them. We'll just wave at them as they sail away.
There's an independence movement within the independence movement.
Well, there's an independence movement that's real, and then there's the psychos that think they can become their own country. But, whatever they do, the more they do stuff like that, the more it makes those of us up here in the northern part of the state, look like the normal people. And it's kind of like, could we get away from the crazy people? Would that be okay? It might not be such a tough argument here shortly. We need to take
the
a really
state of
quick
North California.
Exactly.
They are.
It happened in lots of other places, Carolina.
North and South Dakota, East and West Virginia.
Exactly.
Why not a North and South California?
Exactly.
You get two extra senators.
Well, and that wouldn't be bad. We'd actually get two that have been here. So that would be
there are independence movements in Western Canada. There's an Alberta Independence Party and a Western Canada. They flared. I remember about 20, 30 years ago, they really flared up in popularity, but they were royally squelched by the establishment.
Mars is
I
kinda...
would actually advocate Western Canada joining the United States.
Oh, there you go.
Which is not entirely a popular opinion up here. We had some leading politicians that advocated that before, but that would be it would emancipate us
right.
from Montreal.
Right. See, that's the whole thing. It's like, you know, we're not actually going anywhere. We're just trying to get away from somebody else. It's kind of a strange logic.
Nothing personal.
Yeah, really. We just want to get away from you. We need to take a really quick break. We're going to come back with our guest, William Kay. This is kind of a fun look at what's going on in the climate debate. You know, we can talk about the silly science all day, but the political ramifications are kind of fun. William's site is ecofascism.com. Very interesting. Lots of good stuff there. And you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. Be right back.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies. You twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's busted.
That will keep us on topic. what do you think the guys on the Pacific Rim, you know, what are they going to do if the Russians and the United States just step up and say, you know, we're not doing the climate cap and trade thing and all that jazz?
Every country is going to have a different strategy towards this. So keep in mind, like the Chinese, they always had a path. They were bought into this because they immediately shifted their manufacturing towards solar panels and towards wind turbines, and they're trying to make a profit at it that way. They could very easily adapt to this. Japan is a bit of a different story. They're very much in the same boat as the Europeans. You know, advanced manufacturing country without any natural resources. So they can adapt. Even the Europeans can adapt. But Japan is a country that they have made a huge investment in the electric vehicle and hybrid vehicle market. And that's all predicated on the notion that there's going to be government policies around the world that are going to subsidize or regulate that industry into something much bigger than it is. Right now, hybrid vehicles, electric vehicles, they're only about 1% of global sales of cars. But the plan is that they, you know, like Europe is going to be 100% electric vehicles. Right now, Norway is 12% of new car sales.
Oh, wow.
So there are some of these countries that are really, really putting, well, they give all kinds of subsidies.
Sure.
You know, they're basically lowering the cost for them. They're building all these fast charging stations for free with government money. Without a huge investment of government money, nobody would be buying these products. But Japan, a lot of their big companies have sunk a lot of money into what they think is going to be the future, which is the electric vehicle or at a minimum the hybrid vehicle. So they would not be popular. They wouldn't look forward to it, but they could adapt to it, you know. They're going to have to adapt to it.
Well, here, the more electric cars and stuff they get on the road, now they're realizing, oh, whoops. We don't have enough money in our highway fund because the gas taxes are down. So now they're looking at, you know, vehicle miles traveled, taxes and stuff like that to try to backfill it. I mean, it just seems like every, quote, fix they come up with creates more problems that they need to fix.
Well, it just costs more to operate the way we're operating. It's backwards.
Well, the plan in Europe right now, they are planning to build over 100,000 of those superchargers. Like, the problem is it takes so long to charge up an electric vehicle, sometimes hours and hours, and you only get a very short bit of mileage out of them. That's not a marketable product. So the solution, as far as the geniuses in Europe is concerned, is to build like literally over 100,000 of these superchargers and put them all over the place so you can quickly charge up your car in a matter of minutes and not hours. But that's all government money. And that, you know, that simply would not be happening.
Well, it's still that, you know. We're still looking at the cost of these electric cars is so much more than what you could buy a like-sized conventional car for. You know, most folks can't afford an electric car.
It depends on the
with the subsidies.
Only
the ideologues, only the people who were like so devoted mm-hmm. to this environmental cause are going to buy one now, unless there's all kinds of tax credits, tax breaks. This is not something the market would ever do on its own. And the reality is the price of fuels are probably going to keep falling. We're finding more of them, these deposits. We're getting far more, far improved technologies of extracting them. That this very much argues against the electric vehicle. You know, the old saying is that, you know, that the Stone Age did not end because we ran out of rocks. You know, and we're not going to phase out the petroleum age because we run out of petroleum. Some point down the future, yeah, they're probably going to come up with, you know, electric cars that actually work or whatever. But that's way into the future. And there's no need for us to be accelerating this process.
No, and
there's really no need for any country that's got, you know, a super abundance of fossil fuels to be trying to phase out fossil fuel.
And I think you just create more resistance when you force people to participate in these failing programs. I mean, people don't want to spend their money on something that they know is giving them a bad return. And I think that's what they're doing.
Yeah, it's like I say, it's a political thing. And if you're forcing people to subsidize somebody else's political agenda, ultimately you just had an election in the United States. The good guys won. And I think a lot of these subsidies are going to come to an end. It's going to be a very raucous period. There's going to be a real, resistance to this. And people should really brace themselves for that. All these groups that are showing up to disrupt the inauguration. I was looking at all their sort of communiques they're putting out. Every one of them, I went to Occupy Inauguration and Disrupt J20. They've all got these long spiels about climate change.
Well,
this is why we're going to Washington to do this. And from my point of view, if you are willing to commit an act of violence, you know, like throw a Molotov cocktail at a police car because of climate change,
right?
You are a mass media zombie.
Right.
I mean, this is not something that is really impacting your life at all. You have been driven around the bend by watching these, global warming commercials on TV masquerading as news reports. And that, and these are the ones who think that they're rebels. You know, they're fighting against the man out there. No, these are puppets of the mainstream media.
Right.
Sure.
And they're so incensed by this that they're willing to commit acts of violence. That's my definition of fascism.
Well, historically, too, this group makes a lot of noise. But then when it comes down to the actual protest, show up in front of Trump Tower, they never show up. You know, it's like there's something better on.
And if they do, they just break everything and leave a bunch of garbage.
Yeah, I mean, but they don't show. And instead of having thousands, they have a few hundred, and then the media says it was a million.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, well, there's that. Oh, then a lot of them are paid to show up as well. We're going to see. I think there's actually a change going on. I'm certainly noticing an increase in intensity. And desperation on the part of that community. And there's also a huge infusion of money coming in, and it's going to the more radical elements and the more sort of volatile elements of that community. I really will be watching, the inauguration. I am not going to venture any prediction, but it could really, really get out of hand. If you look, Washington, D.C., 93% of the population voted for Clinton. All along that eastern seaboard, like from New York City, Philadelphia, Baltimore, down to D.C., Clinton was taking over 80% of the vote in those cities. Those are majority non-white cities. I know I was noticing that the internet's coming around to bite us on the ass because they've got a lot of crowd-funded busing now to the inauguration. So they're going to be able to get you on a bus from New York to D.C. for like $10.
Well, yeah. The good news is they'll be trapped in traffic because it's going to be hell.
Yeah, and then most of those folks can't afford to stay there anyway. I mean,
they could stay in jail maybe.
Yeah, but
those are precisely the people who are capable of. I mean, it's a question: what does the elite big green really want to see? What does the real? My takeaway from a lot of this stuff that came out about the leaked dossier and that. You know, Trump has got some enemies in very high places in the government. And so we know he's had enemies in the media. It's a question of how crazy do they want to get this thing? Mm-hmm. Do they really want to see, you know, serious riots in the street? Do they want to shock Trump and the administration but with just, you know, a real blowout riot?
Well, they usually go too far. You know, that's kind of their hallmark is they get all – you know, they get their beer goggles on and you know, they think they're beer muscles. You know, they think, you know, it's like, we can take them. And and they can't, you know, they do things that make, you know, that really hurt, actually wind up hurting their cause. And then some of the people who haven't totally bought in but think it was a good idea look at them and go,
it's going to turn off mainstream America if there's violence. I don't know. I'm conflicted about what's going to happen. You know, I don't want to venture any predictions, but I'm sure looking at some of the stuff coming out of these websites, and they are going to, it's pretty obvious they're committing themselves to disobedience, like blocking the roads, trying to cause some major disruptions there. And
well,
it won't end there.
I watched an interview the other day. I forget who they were talking to, but the premise was there's been more tumultuous times in this country than this Trump election. And so much of what we're hearing about the inauguration and, you know, what's going to happen and all this is all media driven. It's probably going to go off without a hitch.
It's a little bit like the big storms we're all going to die.
They're all talking like there's going to be a big uproar, and there will be some protest. I don't think it's going to be near what these guys are predicting. I think the media is blowing this thing up to where it's just a big nothing. I mean, look at how many people say, "Oh, I'm not going to the inauguration." Well, great, because there's really not going to be room for
you. We did have people cancel tickets. I mean, there were people that had tickets. They go through their local congressional office.
I think there'll be some protesting.
They had tickets, and some people said, you know what? I have security concerned. And then there were other people that are like, we're going, we don't care.
I'm more concerned with some kind of a terrorist act than I am social disobedience.
Well, there's that too.
I think when you get that many people in one place, you're just a target. So, you know.
Hey, we don't want to turn this show into fear porn.
No, stop it.
No, I was trying to do that. I'm not sure.
We'll be free at the end.
It may well be. I've certainly seen what Bill was describing there as the distinct possibility that it's going to be all bark and no bite. We'll see on that.
It'll be interesting to know. We need to take a really quick break, but I was going to ask you, I had read this the other day, the thing about Jane Fonda visiting the oil sands and the people up there in Alberta just went berserk and hammered her. It was kind of fun. I've been reading a lot of the articles online. Misinformed. Even the helicopter pilot
buzzed her.
didn't have anything nice to say. So anyway, I'll post that on our page for today.
Okay.
We'll be back with William Kay. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
We'll
See, if it was a conservative protest, we'd be playing this and having a barbecue and, you know, everybody would bring their kids and be all happy. But this can be one of those, if they do show up, run away, far away. Yeah. All right. So what about Jane Fonda?
The evil Jane Fonda. Alberta.
Mm-hmm.
About a week ago, and no doubt financed by the environmentalist one group or another, and they no doubt flew her very low in a helicopter over what's called these tailing ponds, which are used to sort of, you know, separate the bitumen out with water, and it's kind of a messy, there's clay and crap in them, and they just look like these little miniature lakes, but they're really full of a lot of black gunk. And they no doubt showed her those, and she was horrified, or they showed her some of the open pit mines. The thing with oil sands, some of it's brought up by drilling. A lot of it's brought up. It's just, you go down about 70 or 80 yards, all of the earth, the dirt itself, it's very sandy, but it's got oil in it. So they just have giant front-end loaders, scoop it up, put it in the back of dump trucks. The dump trucks dump it into these watery solutions, and it separates the oil out. It's not like conventional drilling for oil. You're actually just scooping up big amounts of dirt and soaking that in water. I'm simplifying.
Sure.
So it does leave these giant open pit mines. There's four or five of those. A lot of the modern oil sands is done through steam-injected drilling, which isn't going to cause quite the disturbance of the earth. But the opponents to oil sands, these are people who are opposed to the petroleum industry in general. They had long told us that we were running out of oil, but it's these unconventional forms of oil, like the oil sands and shale oil, what have you, now are leading us to the belief that we've got almost unlimited amounts of oil. The estimates of how much oil there are on those oil sands run in the hundreds of billions of barrels, so we are never going to run out of those. So the environmental movement has a particular hate on for oil sands because it means North America will never run out of oil. What we just need is more pipelines to get to the area. But there is quite a disturbance of the earth around the sites of the mines and that. But, you know, I used to work up around Wainwright, Alberta, which is very near some of these. And, you know, what people, it might look nice from the sky, but it's a very inhospitable terrain. It's very much like Siberia or somewhere like that. It's just these very dense, stunted pine forests that are full of various sloughs and swamps. And the moment you're off the road, you're in this, forbidden zone. You can't hardly move through it, and it's very dense mosquitoes. It's a very unpleasant place to be, even in the summertime. In the winter, it's lethal. It's so cold up there.
Mm-hmm.
So we're really dealing with an area that's almost completely unpopulated. There weren't even any Indians living there before this place was settled. The Indians that did move there followed the fur trade. We're dealing with a very inhospitable piece of the earth that isn't really going to bother anybody. It's like, sort of, you're ruining my swamp, man. You're ruining my desert. This is a very unpleasant part. Actually, there's a few, over the years I've read all these environmental articles or counter-environmental articles. There's a whole genre of enviro-skeptical articles where people actually, you read about someplace like the Alaska Wildlife Refuge, and one guy actually went up there and looked at it. And, for most of the year, lethally cold. Unless you're completely dressed up, with heaters and that, you're going to freeze to death in an hour. And even in the summer, the black flies are so thick that you can actually suffocate. They'll fly up your nose and kill you.
God. Well, that's an awesome.
And there's another guy who writes one about this place in eastern Colorado where, they were going to put these diffuser oil and gas installations there. And you go there and it's this sort of semi-arid desert. There's some cactuses and this and that. And they were so worried about the deer population, but in the winter, the deer were hiding around and inside the oil and gas installation to get out of the wind. They were happy to have it there. And it's the same with the caribou herd. They'll walk right by an oil derrick. I mean, they couldn't care less, about these things. But quite often the areas of the world that these people are trying to save, they're, just godforsaken, inhospitable, nasty parts of the world that nobody would go visit if there wasn't some, valuable natural resources there. Nobody was living there. And, it just, if you've ever experienced and had to really deal with, the really hard bush of northern Alberta, the idea that you could somehow damage that is a joke. Even northern Alberta alone is the size of Montana. And when you, I suppose if you're flying low in a helicopter and you go over these nice green spaces and then bonk, suddenly you're in this big open pit mine. Yeah, you know, they describe it as Mordor. This is this horrible place, you know. But the reality is it's an improvement. As far as I'm concerned, it's good landscaping. They can dig all they want there. It's not a place that was of any utility to humans before this.
Well, I guess she went
earlier
up.
Earlier settlers.
Yeah, she.
This oil is, they call it tar, but it's really a really thick carbon-intensive oil called bitumen or pitch. And early pioneers were going through that area, and they would actually sink in up to their knees in some of this petroleum puddle. Like these sort of, it's almost like quicksand.
Mm-hmm.
One early explorer stuck a raft pole, you know, full length of it, you know, 10, 12 feet to the bottom of one of these poles. Other ones complained, you know, they tried to pull their canoe up on a beach on the Athabasca River, and they all sunk into their shins in this gooey black crap, right? So it isn't as though, you know, people are worried about, oh, they're going to spill oil in that river. All along the banks of that river, you find these patches of this thick, tarry, gooey stuff that's already there naturally. And they're worried that, you know, the tailing pond might leak mm-hmm. and a bit of oil might leak into the Athabasca River.
But yeah. See, you don't hear that.
It's saturated with it.
Yeah. Well, that's what this guy was saying. He was just, he said the people were just furious because, you know, after the big fire in Fort McMurray and everything, they're like, we don't need to be bashed by you and your, and because I guess they had, it was Greenpeace and Sierra Club and somebody else who set this thing up. And so I guess that we have all sorts of celebs who fly in and out and and pontificate on something they know nothing about.
We want a classic example. Leonardo DiCaprio
came up
to northern Alberta.
I hate that guy.
And we have a phenomenon here that you don't have in California called a Chinook. And what that is a very warm wind that somehow winds its way through the Rocky Mountains. And when it's super cold in Alberta, every now and then we are saved by a 2 or 3 day Chinook. And you can actually feel the warm wind in your face. But we really look forward to them. You get a couple of them every year. We're experiencing one right now. Leonardo, the climatologist, the genius, shows up. He experiences a Chinook, and he immediately gets on the news saying, you know, this is global warming. It's happening right now. And this is something that happens 2 or 3 times every winter up here, and we really look forward to them up here. But just, you know, an absolute ignoramus. He interpreted that as evidence of global warming.
Well, they wanted, all these guys said that they were all going to leave and move to Canada if Trump got elected. And immediately the internet was flooded with all sorts of.
We're going to build a wall to keep them out.
Well, it was funny because right after that, there were all sorts of things popping up online on the actual requirements to move to Canada and what you had to do and how long it took and what was required. And it was kind of like, hey, just in case you were thinking that, you know, you could actually do this. But, you know, it didn't stop them. They still said it, and they're still here.
Yeah, none of them came, though.
I know.
Well,
I don't understand
that. Planning it, you know. I know that Bernie Sanders, he bought another house right on Lake Champlain so he could actually canoe across the border. Maybe he's thinking about that.
Well, he's old. He's not much of a threat.
Knows? He's buying all these houses these days. Poor Bernie. biggest political fraud I've ever heard.
The guy who's never had a real job.
I saw Michael Moore is going to do a big protest next Thursday in front of Trump Towers, him and Alec Baldwin.
Michael Moore has to do a big protest because he's a big guy.
Everything he does is big.
Everything is big.
He's going to go right for the cafeteria and the food court at Trump Towers, and he's not going to leave.
He's going to stay just sit in at the cafeteria counter.
It's an eat-in with Mike.
He'll show them. He'll eat all their food.
Well, I still think it's funny because the poor guy who wrote that movie Idiocracy periodically pops up on Twitter and he's like, it was never designed to be a documentary. But
I'm just appalled. You know, growing up, I used to listen to Bruce Springsteen, and I can remember, you know, being enough of a naive that when I first saw Roger and Me, you know, you thought that, you know, here's someone who's really sort of fighting for the working man. Those guys have so discredited themselves. They have discredited every bit of, you know, artistic product they have ever created. They aren't just embarrassing themselves now. You know, they are, you know, besmirching everything they have ever done. They've exposed themselves as being these sort of, you know, agents of the oligarchy. They had an opportunity on this election to really take a stand for, you know, the American working people, and they didn't. They jumped over the barricade, and they supported, you know, the candidate of Goldman Sachs and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and they're still not letting go of it. And they're just exposing themselves as being utter charlatans and frauds.
Yeah, and the funny part is that, you know, with all this thing with the Russians, we've talked about this for the last couple of weeks or so, with different people, different perspectives. And with all this talk about the Russians, quote, hacking their system, they keep forgetting to mention that everything that came out was actually true.
Oh, yeah, it was all
Nobody
true information. It was just stuff they were hiding.
They're implying that the Russians made it up and then put it out. It's like, no.
Once those people learned about it,
yeah, those things were all
pissed.
Real.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just funny.
I wholly agree with that statement. And I also think that I agree with what Julian Assange said. It wasn't the Russians. It was an internal leak from the Democratic Party people. Like, that seems to me a lot more plausible.
Yeah. Bernie voter scorn.
Yeah, it was scorn. Bernie Sanders supporters actually released it. They've never proved it. Even though Trump is now sort of going along with the line that the Russians were hacking, that was never established. But yeah, it's a very important point. It wasn't like they were manufacturing evidence. They were revealing the truth about the Democrats.
Yeah, isn't that what they're all about, is telling the truth? I mean,
yeah, they're supposed to be journalists, and they got this scoop, but now they're sort of twisting it all around. Now, you're in for very interesting times south of the border, because this, you know, it's the intelligence agencies themselves are complicit in this, and Trump is really going to have to clean house. He's going to have to get rid of a lot of those people.
Well,
anybody who was involved in putting that, you know, Golden Showers document on Obama's desk, anybody who was involved in getting it there has to be fired.
Yeah. No, I think I agree. It comes the 20th, there's going to be so much turmoil for probably the first few months.
I don't know.
As he goes through the rank and file and starts making changes.
A lot of the rank, but see, a lot of the worst actors.
Oh, they're quitting.
They're gone.
They're leaving before the axe falls.
Ran into one, just for the little caveat before the break here, for the people who follow the Klamath Dams issue and are not on my email list. You should be, and you get the stuff current, you know. But anyway, John Bezdek, the guy that was with Department of the Interior that masterminded a whole bunch of secret meetings with the tribes and the environmentalists and the bureaucrats to remove the dams. And I've been chasing these guys around for, I don't know, several years now. One of our staff ran into him in Washington, D.C. last week, and he said, oh, I retired when Trump got elected. So this is a guy who's been the anti-dam guy, wants to take out all our hydropower dams. And now he's going to go to work for Westland's Water District, biggest water district in California, and help them create water storage.
To put dams in.
So yeah. It's kind of like, I guess the oldest profession is still still the oldest profession, huh? When in doubt, go back to prostitution, huh? It's just crazy.
We say in Canada, the oldest lie is I'm from the federal government and I'm here to help. I mean, a lot of
environmentalists. Some of them are gone. Some of these bad guys are gone.
Help. No, and you know, yeah. I think right now the media is struggling for stories, and that's why so much ridiculous stuff's being reported on. But come the 20th, they're going to have lots to report
on. Because the alternate story is the thing about the winning, right? They're going to have so much winning, they're going to say, please, Mr. President, no more winning.
Please stop. We can't win anymore.
We're going to take a really quick break. We'll come back with our guest, William Kay. You're listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us. if Hillary was elected, we would have used the heck out of that song. So it's just going to languish now. We'll have to work it in.
That was for Jane.
That was for Jane, though. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I mean, yeah, we were just kind of laughing off the air that we bash more. This is like a record breaker show. We have really hammered everybody. Anybody left? Did we not hammer somebody that should be on the list?
Oh, gee, I have a very long list.
I do too.
Of people to beat upon, so we can't get started on that.
We'll have to create our own basket of deplorables.
It would be a truckload.
Yeah, we never got into the science of it, which was okay.
That's,
you know,
all right.
Actually,
it's all fake.
As far as I'm concerned, the science is so settled on the other side that, you know, this is so obviously a concocted scientific hypothesis that is not substantiated by the fact that I always try to go beyond the scientific debate and just, you know, presume people understand that. So my community, more than any, is the skeptical community themselves. But just to throw a word out there to that is that, you know, I'm a member of Friends of Science, and our motto is, you know, climate change, when was the climate not changing? You know, the Earth is 4.5 billion years old. There's constantly been this fluctuation in temperature and atmospheric conditions. What we're seeing now over the last 100, 150 years is well within the range of normal natural climate changes. There's nothing that we are actually witnessing that indicates there's something abnormal going on. And it's also very clear from the record, historical and fossil record, that the warmer the climate, the more abundant the plant and animal life on the planet is. So a slightly warming planet, if indeed that is what we are experiencing, is the best of all conditions.
Oh, yeah.
It's far better to have a warming planet than a cooling one.
And it's the same thing with the CO2. I mean, that has been debunked so many times. It's not going to hurt a thing. Actually, would
two points. No, it's actually going to be fertilizer in the air.
Exactly.
CO2 mixed with water gives you the basic sugars through photosynthesis that is the source of all life on Earth. A lot of studies done, a lot of greenhouses pump CO2 in there. There's been studies that show that the Earth, in fact, is slightly greening. Some deserts are disappearing, probably due to human CO2 emissions. So the overall benefits of CO2 emissions greatly outstrip whatever heat they're trapping.
Sure.
And the warming is probably a benefit, too.
It's kind of interesting that we all learned this as little kids, and somehow they've convinced a bunch of grown-ups that everything they learned in science is somehow different, the exact opposite of what they learned.
National scientific academies are like soldiers in a parade square. Governments can order them around. The European governments, you know, collectively told their scientific establishments in the late 1970s to begin developing this global warming hypothesis and hysteria. This was orders from on high. And the idea that scientists is basically just a civil servant. They are propagandists for the government, or they can certainly be recruited into that. And there's a lot of history for that.
Sure.
So to the extent to which there ever was a scientific consensus, which there never really was, it was only because billions of dollars were flowing from governments into these scientific academies, into the grant-giving agencies that built up these, you know, tens of thousands of scientists who make their living, you know, scratching around for evidence of the global warming hypothesis.
That's the truly sad part, is that we've, you know, bastardized science as a field. And told him, you know, you can't study anything unless you study this and come up with this conclusion, which is obviously not science.
William, thank you very much. We got to have
My
you
pleasure.
Back. We've got so much to talk about. And, of course, after the 20th, we'll have even more to talk about.
Yes, we will.
Let's take a good hard look. My prediction is a lot more disruption and violence than one might expect.
All right, we're going to hold
you
there.
Go.
All right, thanks for coming on, William.
Bye. My pleasure. Bye.
Thanks very much. You can find all the information about our guest, William Kay, at wethepeopleradio.us. And thanks again to Powerhouse Solar.